You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Whatever the occasion, effortless elegance is right this way. Because Hilton brings you new ways to stay, courtesy of the Nomad London. And it doesn't stop at award-winning dining in a space draped in velvet and illuminated by vintage chandeliers. No, this day goes beyond with unparalleled personalized service and attentive hospitality. Oh, and did we mention the Nomad London can be booked using your Hilton Honors points at Hilton.com? Hilton, for the stay.
At Capella University, you can learn at your own pace with our FlexPath learning format. Take one or two courses at a time and complete as many as you can in a 12-week billing session. With FlexPath, you can finish the bachelor's degree you started in 19 months and under $19,000. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu. Fastest 25% of students. Cost varies by pace, transfer credits, and other factors. Fees apply.
Hi, it's Molly. 2025 is the year of big change in science funding as federal spending is slashed for public agencies. Both science and science journalism are under siege. But you can help by supporting this independent journalism endeavor. By donating to Big Picture Science, you help us continue to bring you important science research within its context. This episode you're about to hear is an example of the kind of original reporting that your support allows us to do. If you've already joined us at Patreon, thank you. If you haven't, it's easy to do. Just go to patreon.com/bigpicturescience. It doesn't cost much. For as little as $2 a month, you get early access to ad-free versions of each episode. If you support independent science journalism and Big Picture Science in particular, you can let us know in a way that makes a big difference. Please join us at patreon.com/bigpicturescience. And thank you. When Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans 20 years ago, the high winds knocked out infrastructure, including power grids. Landline phones, cell service, and internet service were all out. Louisiana and Mississippi governors Kathleen Babineau-Blanco and Haley Barbour described the damage.
The situation is terrible. There's no electricity anywhere in the city. It's very hard to make people comfortable anywhere. They're in desperate need of water, of supplies. We're ferrying in as much as we can.
The devastation in so many places is just total. I mean, from the railroad to the beach, for 25 or 30 miles, 90% of the structures are just totally destroyed. I mean, like they'd been a nuclear weapon set off.
But one local network was intact. It came alive to keep important information flowing. Its members raised antennas, sometimes climbing onto roofs to do so, and powered up a century-old technology. As we enter another hurricane season 20 years after Katrina, we consider the lesson that it taught us about being prepared for a natural disaster on an unimaginable scale. In our previous episode, we considered what we've learned about hurricanes and our state of readiness since Katrina. In this episode, we talked to ham radio operators about how establishing new lines of communication when others go down can be the difference between life and death, and why, in the age of cell phones, AI, and funding cuts to the agencies that keep us informed during chaotic catastrophes, shortwave radio may represent our last antennas standing. Welcome to Big Picture Science. I'm Molly Bentley. This episode, our second in our series marking the 20th anniversary of Katrina, is called Hurricane Comms. In our previous episode, emergency manager Megan Enright on the island of St. John in the Virgin Islands described being in the dark literally and figuratively in 2017 after the devastating Category 5 Hurricane Irma knocked out power and almost all modes of communication, all but a few.
Loss of communication after Irma became really clear that we needed to rely on different types of technologies. Amateur radio, ham radio operators have become a really critical part of our preparedness, and more people across the territory are taking their ham radio tests so that they can be operators.
We spoke to some of those dedicated shortwave radio enthusiasts at the National Hurricane Conference in New Orleans this spring. They described the lifeline that amateur radio operators provide during storms and other natural disasters. And we'll hear how they kept us talking to each other during Katrina a little later in the show. But first, let's hear what shortwave radio is, how it got started, and why ham operators can keep talking when other forms of radio communication go down. After all, this technology is more than a century old. In 1901, a historic radio transmission from England to eastern Canada established the practicality of radio communication long distance.
Those sounds, ladies and gentlemen, were a simulation of the letter S in Morse code, which were the first sounds to be transmitted across the Atlantic Ocean by wireless telegraphy by the late Senator Guglielmo Marconi.
When Italian Senator Marconi, whose death inspired that 1937 tribute, sent electromagnetic waves from transmitter to receiver over the Atlantic, he was drawing on Heinrich Hertz's work that had demonstrated the existence of electromagnetic waves and their application for speed of light communication. This all laid the groundwork for radio, television, radar, and other wireless technologies.
I prepared a love song, really rather neat, calling this a love song, my sweeter than sweet.
Marconi's experiments used long wave signals, but today's amateur radio operators also use short waves, which allows for smaller antennas and operation over long distances, even over hundreds of miles. Well, it didn't take long for amateur or ham radio operators to make practical use of Marconi's breakthrough experiment. But ham radio operators aren't broadcasting like AM radio does. Broadcasting talks to everyone, and everyone cannot talk back. Ham radio is a licensed one-to-one communication between individuals or nets. That is, a group conversation where people take turns talking. And they keep going through power outages because ham radios draw on battery power, and they're not reliant on cell towers or internet cables. And one more thing. Amateur radio operators take advantage of a layer in the Earth's atmosphere, the ionosphere, that, thanks to the energy of sunlight, contains many charged particles. This makes it essentially a mirror for radio waves, especially high-frequency radio waves, or short waves, that can repeatedly bounce between the Earth and this layer and hop around the planet. This permits communication over great distances. For nearly a century, radio amateurs have taken advantage of this bouncing wave phenomenon.
Oh, you're coming in pretty good. Yep. Transmission sounds absolutely fine over here. How do I sound coming back to you? This is KC0USM. Name here is Brandon. Bravo Romeo Alpha November, Delta Oscar November. Welcome to the hobby. I think you'll enjoy it.
And if you have a receiver for a particular frequency, you can pick up the wave, even if you don't have a ham radio license required for talking over one. So when Hurricane Katrina made landfall and residents of the Gulf States and the National Hurricane Center could no longer receive internet, cell phone, or landline communications from the affected areas.
Here is a look at the storm as we come on the air tonight. Right now, it is making its way north over the Mississippi-Alabama border, heading for Tennessee, where inland flooding is a major problem now tonight. Last night, when this storm was a monster, Category 5.
These three amateur radio operators turned on their radios, selected the appropriate frequency bands, and began sharing information.
I'm Bobby Graves. I'm the net manager for the Hurricane Watch Net. Amateur radio call sign is KB5HAV. Currently live in Starkville, Mississippi, but lived most of my life in the Jackson, Mississippi area.
My name's Matt Anderson, radio call sign KD5KNZ. Been one of the volunteers at the State Emergency Operations Center since about 2003 and was active during Hurricane Katrina there.
My name's Julio Rapol. I'm a coordinator and the founder of the ham radio station at the National Hurricane Center, and I live in Miami, Florida, and I've been a volunteer at the Hurricane Center now 45 years.
We'll hear their stories from Katrina later in the show, but first, they describe how these boundary-defined shortwaves are used in a crisis, and Julio shares how his radio hobby turned into 40 years of public service.
When I was at the University of Miami, the Hurricane Center says, "Do you have a ham radio operator you can lend us for a hurricane?" And the University of Miami said, "Yeah, Julio lives across the street." And I was like, okay, you know, and I put my radio in a cardboard box, went across the street and put up a little wire antenna, and the director of the Hurricane Center came in. He says, "Can you talk to St. Lucia? There's a Category 5 hurricane that is coming over." And I talked to them, and I said, "Is there anything you need?" He says, "Yeah, we have hundreds of injured people." And by coincidence, a British hospital ship was one day sailing from that island. The hospital ship got on the air and says, "You know, if you can get the prime minister to give us permission to land, we can lend medical help." In about 15 minutes, the prime minister of St. Lucia got on the radio with little old me, a kid in college, and said, "You relay to them that I give them permission, they can come in." And I mean, it was amazing. And that impressed me, and it made our station there a permanent fixture.
Well, amateur radio is basically just going back to the basics, just sort of stringing up a wire antenna and just find the frequency it's tuned for and just start trying to make contacts with whoever comes up on the other end.
And the reason they call it amateur is because we don't get paid. We do a lot of volunteer work. We do a lot of public service work. And the big value is emergency communications when everything else fails.
Many people who are the operators have other jobs. I believe, yes. Julio, you're an architect, for example.
Yes.
So in addition to your other jobs, you're doing this, but also you're trained.
Depending on the role, they're specially trained to do hurricane communications, for example, and they know what to ask and how to speak with the people that are being affected with hurricanes. And, you know, we, for the Hurricane Center, we have specific weather questions we ask them.
So be very clear, why is it that you gentlemen are able to communicate, and the other hams, as you call them, when the other communications go down?
I think a lot of it is one of the things with our license is we're allowed to talk on multiple frequencies, all the way to down, like where the AM radio station frequencies, all the way up to the higher frequencies on the portable radios. Where most public safety people, they're on a specific frequency at a specific location. We can actually take our equipment and pretty much go anywhere in the United States, in some cases even out of the United States.
So to help us extend further, the lower in frequency you go, the further the radio frequencies will travel. That's the reason why, say like your AM radio in your car. Have you ever noticed when you listen to it at nighttime, you can hear stations states away? Well, that's how the lower frequencies work. And ham radio operators, we have frequencies in some of those same areas. In other words, depending on who we're wanting to talk to, how far away they are, as ham operators, we know this group of frequencies will allow us to have that kind of transmitter range, and we can utilize those. Whereas in the public sector and government, they may not have that because they're just licensed for one group of frequencies, maybe just one frequency.
Ham radio has a million frequencies. So if you randomly try any frequency, it's hit and miss. So the Hurricane Watch Net is on 14.325 megahertz. And he has a couple dozen hams from all over the country, the Caribbean, South America, during hurricane season that monitor that frequency.
As I would say, at the state, we've got a little different role up there. Mainly the state is to support all the local governments. So we're doing all the local traffic back and forth. But we normally have a radio with their frequency on so we can monitor, we can hear what's going on. And if we do run across something that needs to be passed up to them, we'll always get on the frequency and relay that up to them.
When you say you're working with the state, does that mean that you are a professional or are you still an amateur?
No, it's all volunteer.
Can you give me a scenario of what it looks like when you're communicating during a disaster? Are you all together in your homes? Are you in a command central? Just to give a visual picture, if you will, of what ham operators, where they're operating from.
I would say 90% of them are operating from their own home. Okay, we do have, for instance, at the Hurricane Center, we have a group of about 30 operators. And we have a big station there. We have 7 antennas, and we operate from there. But we're talking to other ham operators from their home in the islands that are giving us the weather reports, you know, the wind direction, the barometric pressure, and what they see on the ground. They're eyewitnesses, where the hurricane specialists can't see what's happening on the ground. They have data. They have, you know, satellite data. They have air reconnaissance, hurricane hunters, things like that. But they cannot see what's happening on the ground. And it's very simple. You don't have to have $1,000 radio station for that. You can have a simple radio station and a wire antenna, we call a dipole, or it could be a long wire, because the wire flexes in the wind. It doesn't break. That signal bounces. It goes up, bounces off the upper layer of the atmosphere called the ionosphere, which acts like a mirror. Imagine you shine a flashlight to a mirror. Depending on the angle, you'll see it bounce down. Well, that's what the ionosphere does with radio signals. It bounces it back down depending on the angle that it goes up. And it could land anywhere from 1,000 miles to 10,000 miles away.
Matt, can you just give me a description or just an idea of the sort of information or the data that individuals are collecting? Are they just going outside and looking at the conditions? Are you using instrumentation? What sort of information are you collecting?
It could be both. You know, the Hurricane Center, they're looking for specific information. So a lot of times locally, at least, you know, in my experience with the local emergency operations centers, sometimes we'll get that information in and we'll be able to relay that in. It's always better if somebody has a weather station and, you know, they can provide accurate information instead of just guessing. But, you know, storm damage, they're going to want to hear that report whether you have a weather station or not.
But then you have places that don't have all that sophisticated equipment. And so I'll give you an example. There was a hurricane that hit the North Abacos Island, and we had a ham radio operator there. And he had a weather instrument giving us wind reports, wind direction, barometric pressure, and they loved that because they didn't have any other information from that island. There was this Hurricane Fabian, Category 5, and I was talking him live on the air, and the hurricane forecasters came in behind me, and I says, what does he see? Because if we don't have weather data, but at least we can imagine what he's going through. So I talked to him. His name was Ed. And I said, Ed, without going outside, can you see out your window? Do you see anything? He says, yes, I do. He says, I'm looking out my window and I'm looking south, and the three houses south of me have all floated off their foundations and are in the middle of the street. So that gives them a picture of it. And they said, now we know they had a very major storm surge where the ocean water rises and pushed those houses into the sea.
You know, the amateur radio operators have been described as old school, right?
Dinosaurs.
But also dinosaurs, as you say. And I'm wondering if you could just defend that charge of being dinosaurs. What does it mean to be old school or old tech in a world that is increasingly high tech?
Yeah, well, amateur radio is over 100 years old, and people think that since it's not computerized and digitized, that it doesn't matter anymore. But we use basic radios, and we are probably in the world close to 6 million, I think, and ham radio has no borders.
I think a lot of it, and I do commercial radio work for a living, a lot of it is we have this new technology, we have satellites, we have, you know, cell phones, we can do all this great stuff, but all that relies on an infrastructure. And it could be just something simple, like here in New Orleans, the switch station goes underwater. Your phone still has power, but you can't talk to anybody because they can't route the signal through the system to be able to communicate who you want to. And as hams, like you say, you can go to the simplest radios, Julio suggested, just a wire antenna out the wall, you can talk to somebody. Or we have options, we can go to other higher tech means that allow us to actually transmit data over the air. So you can actually send an email. If you remember in the old days when everybody had AOL, you had an external modem and you hooked it up to your phone, we have things similar to that where we can actually send that message over the air and it would wind up, you know, at the Hurricane Center or whoever needs it.
Next, Matt, Julio, and Bobby describe how ham radio operators got ready as Hurricane Katrina neared the Gulf Coast.
One, I'm thinking, this is going to be a history-making storm. I told my wife and told my family, I said, we're going to be without power for a while.
This episode of Big Picture Science, the second in our series tied to the 20th anniversary of Katrina, is called Hurricane Comms. We've been hearing about how devastating hurricanes can be and how important it is to track them and prepare for their arrival. This is a time for us to increase our efforts to understand hurricanes to minimize their damage as much as possible. Big Picture Science is committed to bringing on-the-ground reporting about this and other critical science topics every week. But good journalism isn't free to produce. Your donations can go a long way in supporting our original reporting. You can join us at patreon.com/bigpicturescience to get started, and no amount is too small. Our members enjoy early access to ad-free versions of each episode and access to exclusive bonus material. It's easy to pitch in, and we hope that you do so by joining us at patreon.com/bigpicturescience. And thank you.
Running a business comes with a lot of what-ifs. But luckily, there's a simple answer to them. Shopify. It's the commerce platform behind millions of businesses, including Thrive Cosmetics and Momofuku, and it'll help you with everything you need. From website design and marketing to boosting sales and expanding operations, Shopify can get the job done and make your dream a reality. Turn those what-ifs into... Sign up for your $1 per month trial at shopify.com/special offer.
When 100-mile-an-hour winds knock out power lines, an area can literally be in the dark. No lights, no cell phone, no internet. But the director at the National Hurricane Center in Miami, Florida, Michael Brennan, knows that he can rely on another set of eyes, ears, and antennae on the ground.
In some cases, amateur radio is the only communication left if you have an island or a locality where the communication infrastructure is otherwise, you know, down for whatever reason. They have an amateur radio set up here at the Hurricane Center. It's been around for, you know, 40 plus years, and it continues to be an important part of the data collection that we pull in here, both for real-time meteorological data, but also impacts as they're occurring during an event.
One of those ham radio operators that the National Hurricane Center heard from during Katrina was Julio Rapol, the volunteer with his own office at the NHC in Miami. Mr. Rapol is part of a larger network of ham radio operators spread out across the Gulf Coast. And as we consider our readiness for hurricanes 20 years after Katrina, our reliance on cell phones, and the prospect of large funding cuts to agencies such as the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the National Hurricane Center, highlight our vulnerability. But volunteer radio operators represent a beacon of self-sufficiency in these uncertain times, being immune from budget cuts. Come rain or high winds, they will continue to relay important information during some of our biggest national emergencies. And as Julio Bobby Graves and Matt Anderson describe it, the century-old technology bouncing radio waves off the ionosphere is not just a thing of the past. Bobby describes the approach of Hurricane Katrina 20 years ago.
I remember when I was coming off the west coast of Florida, I started looking at the hurricane tracking software along with all the data the Hurricane Center was putting out. And all indications were showing as the next few hours keep going, the track keeps moving towards Mississippi. And next thing you know, now this thing's all of a sudden now a Category 5. They weren't expecting to become a Category 5. And now we got a monster out there.
And Matt, you were in New Orleans at the time?
I was at the State Emergency Operations Center in Baton Rouge. And once it got a little bit closer, we started going in and checking our equipment. And, you know, I guess, I don't know, probably the day before is when we realized it was definitely coming this way.
And then we set up a schedule with all the ham operators, activate the station, turn it on, make sure everybody's on a net. And that's how we get started. And then we need the stations at the affected area. That's the most important thing, because we're all there waiting to hear from them.
To communicate with you?
Or yes, they're the ones that have to have their emergency antenna out, which it could be a wire, and they have to have their backup power.
But the problem is, I'm now in the path of this monster coming at us. I'm 150 miles inland, living in Pearl, Mississippi. It's a suburb just east of Jackson. And, you know, watching this thing, and what blew my mind is when not only did it blow up to Category 5, the overall size of the storm itself was, you know, took up half the Gulf of Mexico. This is going to be a history-making storm. God have mercy on everybody in the path of this thing. I told my wife and told my family, I said, we need to start stocking up for this thing. It's going to be bad. We're going to be without power for a while.
Matt, now the descriptions that Bobby gave of watching Hurricane Katrina come in, kind of can't believe what he's seen. Was that your experience too up in Baton Rouge? Because you're not right on the coast. You're not in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
You're up about 60 miles or so. But what was your experience when it was dawning on you just what a monster storm it was?
Yeah, I remember watching some of the live video by the lakefront just north of town here. And the waves are going over the seawall there, and it's normal storm stuff. And, you know, we knew it was going to be bad, and then we started getting reports of the flooding that started coming in over the radio. So we knew the wind damage was bad, but, you know, once those flood walls started falling and, you know, places started getting flooded and we were getting those reports, you know, we knew that it was going to be even more serious at that point.
When you say you were getting those reports and you were watching video of the water coming over the levees, mm-hmm. At what point did all of that go silent, and were you just communicating with the amateur radio operators, just communicating without that assistance?
Probably not too long after that.
Because the power went out.
Yeah, the power and the flooding, I think, is what affected a lot of them.
Julio, can you just give me an idea now? You were in Miami. It had skipped you. Why were these kind of communications so critical during Katrina? If you can just help us really understand of the sorts of information that was being passed during the storm, information that just wouldn't have been transmitted had you not had these amateur radio operators.
Yeah, well, even though we're at the Hurricane Center and they're looking for weather data to be able to help them get better understanding of the track of the storm, right where our radio room is, across from us is the main hurricane center. That's where all the hurricane directors and forecasters and specialists are there. Right next to them is the FEMA office. And when we have reports that are damage reports, they want to hear that. And just give you an example, we were the first to hear from a ham radio operator that was volunteering at the Superdome. And he communicated with us and told us that part of the roof was flying off the Superdome. Nobody had heard about that before. And then we did our report and gave it to the FEMA office there, who then communicated to all the people who can go and help at that time. But that was at the peak of the hurricane.
We have audio of a gentleman from Slidell.
Okay, overall peak at 120 knots. Okay.
Who was, I believe, a radio operator during Katrina. And can you just summarize what was happening in that audio exchange?
We were at the Hurricane Center operating, and several of the National Weather Services in that area, including Slidell as well, and they had lost all communications. Their satellite dishes blew away.
I should just say that Slidell is right in the New Orleans area.
Yes, it is. And they had lost all communications, and he came up and he says, can you contact these stations? And we put it like an all points bulletin. Can you find someone in Slidell? And it just so happens that one of the people in the Slidell NWS office was a ham radio operator, and he had a radio that was still functioning there. And we were able to communicate with him. His name was Sean. I remember that.
And the current peak, 90 knots. Overall peak, 120 knots. Over.
Roger that. Can we have a time for the peak, please?
And we said, Sean, you need to talk to the head of the NWS here and give him whatever data you're with. You're about to get landfall soon.
Okay, very good. 5 minutes ago. 5 minutes ago, Ken, over.
Roger, the 5 minutes ago. Okay, so Charlie, are you catching this?
And that was the only person we can talk to there, and he stayed with us, and he gave us the average and peak wind reports and everything. And then the Slidell office says we have 41, I forgot what he called them, 41 souls. There were 41 staff members inside the building. They could not get out of the building. The trees were all fallen. The streets were all blocked. This is right after the eye moved over them. They had no other communications. So we stayed with them for 6 hours. And we would get the name, phone numbers, and all that of their family members to let their family know that they were okay.
So I think just to emphasize the point about location, so some hams are going to work from home. They're going to be on their radios communicating either locally or on that high-frequency radio communicating, you know, longer distances like back to the hurricane center. Other groups of hams, they'll actually show up at the emergency operations center, kind of like they do in Miami. We'll show up in Baton Rouge at the state EOC, the New Orleans EOC, or different places like that. So we'll have a combination, and that really helps in areas because it's like we can get a hold of places because there's people scattered out in multiple areas on multiple different systems.
So you're really nimble. I mean, you're agile in a way that other communication systems are not.
Yes.
One of the things that was talked about in this session was that these operators can help save lives. And can you give me an example of some information that was shared during Katrina that you think helped people or helped the National Hurricane Center or other officials actually make critical decisions?
In the beginning, we were getting a lot of rescue calls. That people, like you said, their phones didn't work. They had their ham radio, the portable radio. They were able to get on the repeaters, and those were still working at the time. And they would say, there's people at this house, at this address. Well, one guy calls in on the radio and says, I've got, you know, 10 people were on the roof of this house. So we get the information. We turn it in to people that get sent out for rescue. Well, a little while later, we start getting other calls, and it's the same guy. And he's relaying other calls for other people that need to be rescued while he's standing on the roof of a house. And we're telling him, hey, you may want to save your battery if you're stuck up there. And he's like, no, I want to help. You know, I'm going to try to do what I can. And it's just that type of thing, you know, that's ham radio is a hobby, but it's also a public service. When you see something like this, people are going to try to do what they can to help.
And one of the things that I remember happening was that the rescue helicopters were not being able to communicate to the ground, to the hospitals. And I remember there was an article written about that where ham radio operators then would ride with a helicopter pilot, communicate to hams on the ground, and coordinate the landing for that helicopter and rescue of people. So, I mean, we fit in little gaps in many different ways with the communications.
One little thing I did in my neighborhood after the storm was over is I took, even though my HF rig operated off of AC in the house, I had a means when I took it outside to like my pickup truck, I could run off of the battery in my truck. So I had a big beam antenna. I could still, you know, turn the power on it to aim the beam where I wanted, but then I'm operating my radio from my truck. Well, a lot of people in my neighborhood knew I was a ham operator, but they just never really understood what ham radio could do. And she said, I know you got this, Bobby, but, you know, what can you do? What can it do, you know, after this big storm? Because, you know, I knew what they were wanting. No power lines, no telephone, no internet. How do I contact my family to let them know I'm okay? I said, you want to contact your family? I said, what's your family's telephone number? What do you mean? I said, well, you're getting ready to talk to them. I contacted a buddy of mine in another state. I said, can you run a phone patch for me? Sure, Bobby. What's the phone number? And what a phone patch is, when you tie your telephone in to the radio, they can connect together. And then he called their family up, and they were able to talk to one another on the phone, let them know, hey, I'm okay. It's just not relaying, you know, from point A to point B. Hey, your family's okay. They actually got to hear the voice, and they know, there's no doubt. Tears just coming down their face. Mm-hmm. And you can't put a price on that.
Well, one could say that Hurricane Katrina, because it was 20 years ago, that was 20 years ago. Technology has advanced since then. What is the case of why ham radio operators are still needed today? And you can take into consideration if you like, the fact that there may be cuts to some agencies that usually provide federal response. But why is it still needed today?
Well, ham radio, and they sometimes call us dinosaurs. And my motto is, and from the Weather Channel, Mike Bettis, I have to give him credit. He says, you may be a dinosaur, but you're still not extinct. And he hit it on the head, because we use technology that may be over 100 years old, but it's stable. Where now everything is connected through the internet or through satellites or all these things, and it's fantastic and high speed and digitized and all that. And all you need is one wire to get cut, and then it stops. So that's why ham radio is still the backbone when everything else fails.
With all the technology we got, it's fantastic when it works. Yeah. But you let one little piece break, and it's like, take a bunch of dominoes, the whole thing comes down. Mm-hmm. But guess what? Ham radio will always still be there.
Thank you so much for this conversation, Bobby Graves.
Thank you very much.
And Julio Rapol.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to give you this information to promote our hobby and public service.
Exactly.
And Matt Anderson, thank you so much.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you for coming to the conference.
Bobby Graves is the net manager for the Hurricane Watch Net Amateur Radio. Call sign is KB5HAV. Matt Anderson, radio call sign KT5KNZ, has been a volunteer at the Louisiana State Emergency Operations Center for more than 20 years. And Julio Rapol is a coordinator and the founder of the ham radio station at the National Hurricane Center, where he's been a volunteer for more than 40 years. Along with the use of old-school technology that Marconi, the father of wireless technology, would recognize, is a much more recent one being used in emergency situations.
The only thing that we don't have a lot of is time, 24 hours in a day, right? And so AI or machine learning, they help us compress time, shorten that decision-making process.
The role for AI in hurricane and disaster preparations and its limits next. This episode of Big Picture Science, our second in a series tied to the 20th anniversary of Katrina, is called Hurricane Comms.
The new McCrispy strip is here. Dip approved by ketchup, tangy barbecue, honey mustard, Sprite, McFlurry, Big Mac sauce, double dipped in buffalo and ranch, more ranch, and creamy chili McCrispy strip dip. Now at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
While amateur radio has been responding to disasters as they unfold for nearly a century, some emergency managers also incorporate a much newer technology into hurricane and disaster preparedness, artificial intelligence. AI-generated emergency plans and alerts, reviewed by humans, are sometimes sent out to the public in advance of incoming storms. But as emergencies still demand hands-on response, we'll hear from two professionals about the uses of AI technology and its limits.
Hi, my name is Todd DeVoe. I'm the Emergency Management Coordinator for the City of Inglewood, California.
Hi, my name is Brian Head. I am the chair of the Fire, Rescue, Law Enforcement, and Military track for the National Hurricane Conference. I'm also Executive Director with Buffalo Computer Graphics and a former employee with the New York State Emergency Management Office.
Todd and Brian have dedicated their lives to helping people when disaster hits. But while on opposite coasts, they have collaborated to manage the response to some of our biggest natural disasters, including Hurricane Katrina in 2005.
With Hurricane Katrina, and certainly Rita that came, right along as well, we were involved with what's called the Emergency Management Assistance Compact. And when Katrina and Rita came through, we were assisting, whether that was with resources, personnel, or with missions like, taking in displaced residents or individuals that needed shelter.
So to be clear about that, with when you're sharing resources in an emergency, in Katrina, you were welcoming people from Louisiana and Mississippi to New York. That was part of what it meant to share resources and reach out to people who were in crisis.
Yeah, I think when you looked at the evacuation, there were a lot of inland evacuations to some of the states that were contiguous, but then there were plans set in place to take individuals further away from harm's way.
I have a feeling that there may be many people that don't understand all that is involved with emergency management. I mean, you're directing across so many fronts. Now you're smiling and laughing, Todd, if you can tell us why, and then also give us a thumbnail sketch of what it is that it entails.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, because that's the biggest question that we get is like, what do you do as emergency management? Like, what do you do? Like, what? We sent 28 ambulances on the first day of Katrina to come out here.
Excuse me, from LA to the Gulf.
Mm-hmm. From LA to the Gulf. And we had people on the ground here in Louisiana, in New Orleans and Baton Rouge, and everybody came all out of here, which is interesting because you think, oh, you're only working your disaster like here. Everybody's on the ground. We're working it from 3,000 miles away.
So I think from an emergency manager's side, kind of we talked about the differences between a firefighter or an EMT or a paramedic or law enforcement that's on the ground. They're boots on the ground. So we'll say they're boots on the ground, tip of the spear, right? That's, so we need to support them. So emergency management is really about that position of coordination. It could be somebody that, if you go back to Katrina, there was a lot of communication outages. There were times that in New York State, we had an old civil defense network. It was a communications network. It was hardwire copper that connects all the states. We were able at times to take one of our messages that we received. So someone got a text message out, they got somehow out to a cell tower that was working. Those individuals could get that message to us. We were still able to communicate with the state of Louisiana through that civil defense network. So we could provide them with, this is the address that the person is on their roof and needs help, the water's rising, or they're in their attic and they can't get out and the water's rising. And there were confirmed cases where we were able to pass emergency life safety information through that old civil defense network when no one else could get calls in. So sometimes calls would go out, but you could not get a call in on the traditional landlines into the state EOC or into some of the first responders.
Now, given the description that you two gentlemen have presented, it sounds like a very physical job. I mean, this sounds like a job for human beings, not for machines, and certainly not for AI. And what we're about to talk about now is the way in which AI, artificial intelligence, can help you do your jobs. And it's not intuitive. So you're going to have to sell us on it. I'll start with you, Todd. How can AI be used in disaster situations?
So the only thing that we don't have a lot of is time. It's 24 hours in a day, right? We have hours that we're awake. We need to be sleeping at some point. And so what we need to do, everything possible to compress our time. And so AI or machine learning, language models, they help us compress time, shorten that decision-making process. And that keeps us in there to be able to write something down. And it takes tasks off of our plate that would take us time to do, that where we can put that time back into other areas of the decision-making matrix.
I want to ask you for examples, but to be clear, we're talking about large language models. We're talking about generative AI. Mm-hmm. And some people may know one example as ChatGPT. That is what is being employed in these emergency situations, Brian?
So I think when you look at some of the AI that's being used, the real differentiator, is it generative or predictive AI? And how are you using that tool for the different tasks that you are responsible for? Predictive model is when people say, I have a hurricane that's going to hit my county at this time with these conditions. Tell me how many individuals will be impacted, how much of a water situation will I have with flooding, whether that's inland or coastal. And at that point, there are just so many factors that go into those decisions. Those predictive models are not accurate. They just aren't. But people want them to be. So back to the generative model, where you would say, these are my conditions. What are the things that I could expect could happen? And we really do that day to day when we talk to the National Weather Service on a weather call. We'll say to them, do you have an example of a storm in the past this may be similar to? And they'll say, yes, in 95, this is the storm that we can say will most closely resemble what's going to happen. So you look around the room and you go, who was here in 95? And because it's a government agency, you never know. Is everyone turned over? Do we have someone that remembers what those impacts are? And a lot of times it's going back to a file drawer, to a file box, and pulling the information from that incident, if you had someone that did good documentation. Well, if I have a generative model and I can tie those different historical incidents into that, well, I've created a library now. For example, and I think Todd would back me up on this, every after action report of every incident has communication is the number one thing that everybody needs to improve on, right?
Yeah,
What do you mean communication has to be improved on?
It's everything,
That's
right? It's internal communication, it's external communication, it's communication with the public. What types of AI could you use for that? So that generative AI of saying, how can I develop some templates for my public messaging?
And I'll use a really good example. If you've never been to Los Angeles or Los Angeles County, right, and you go, and I say for you to go north of the 405, what does that mean to you? It means nothing, right? Because the 405 is a north-south freeway. Does it mean I have to go all the way to the end of it? Or does it mean at the one area where it's a east-facing freeway, does it mean do I go north of that? So what does that mean? So there's a very bad way for me to tell you to evacuate. So you could load test that message through ChatGPT and say, does this make sense to you? And can you, and so it will give you feedback of saying, no, it doesn't, or yes, it does, or this is how you can improve it. And so you keep testing your messages without having to send them out. And so we can improve that messaging to make sure that when we do put an evacuation order out, the people who aren't familiar with the area are going to still be able to follow and save lives.
Well, Brian, the example that Todd gave in how to improve messaging around disasters for people to prepare or maybe in the middle of them, how to evacuate, makes sense. But how can AI help do the job that you do, which is coordinate all of these different resources?
For me personally, I use it as a tool to help inform me of the decision that I'm going to make, not make the decision for me. And I think that's the big difference. So I don't want it to tell me these are the decisions and just blindly implement those. But what I do want to do is, again, back to that response model, if we have our own, let's say, system set up where individuals want information. Where's the closest shelter? Where can I get gas, right? That's always a big thing. You know, which gas stations have a generator? If I can create a bot that has that library of data, then that's going to take relief off individuals that may be doing more life safety communications back and forth.
Some of the attendees at this conference that I spoke with are ham radio operators.
Yeah.
So if we're talking, are you?
KI6RBW.
What are your call letters?
It's a KI6RBW.
Okay. So you know probably where I'm coming from with this next question is that that's old school technology. That's technology that's like 100 years old or so. And it goes to your point, Brian, of when you were stuck on the East Coast, you tapped into that civil defense copper wire, which is going to be news to some young people listening to this. But one could be excused for thinking that AI perhaps could help you before a disaster and maybe after disaster, but during it, when the power is out and you don't have Wi-Fi and you don't have computers, maybe you're reaching for the candle, AI is not going to be able to help you in those situations. And is there a danger that there will be an over-reliance on the technology and that we're going to pull back from some of those on-the-ground skills and training that only human beings have?
So, you know, do we start relying on technology too much? You know, sometimes we do. We're there already where we're over-reliant on technology. That being said, talked about the idea of having drills where you say, hey, guess what? Your computers aren't working. And here's a pad of paper.
Training people, reminding people what it was like in maybe 1995 or 1990, something like that. Brian, what do you think about this? You gave the great example of using copper wire in an emergency when you had no other route to get the messages across. What happens to some of that old school experience?
So the copper line that I was talking about is the National Alert and Warning System, or NAWAS, they call it. Those tests are done daily, and I used to supervise some of those operators from our agency, and they would say to you, why are we doing this? Like, we've got phone, we've got IP-based phones, we've got internet, you know, why do we need to do this? And I think it goes to Todd's point that when you have these different electronic systems, what are your backups? What can you fall back to? Because ultimately, we are supposed to be up when everyone else is down. And I think that's something that gets lost sometimes because we get so reliant on always having something and getting used to having something 90% of the time that we don't advocate and keep those backups. So when you build a new EOC or you build a new fire station, are you putting those backups in or are you just adopting the latest and greatest? And will that fail? What are those failure points? I think it goes to process. That's one thing that I'm a big believer in. If you do not understand the process that goes into the solution that you're working with, how do you do it if it's not there? Everybody just looks around and goes, they used to do it for us. I don't know what to do.
You got to pull the T cards.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
So an example of AI, you don't often see the process. The AI just spits out the answer,
right.
And you don't know actually how it got there. But the human beings, for example, before AI, they would have had to make many decisions and synthesize a lot of information. They would have understood the process. And I think in the session, you said you're not worried about humans being out of the loop. You're worried about humans becoming lazy.
Yes.
And can you describe what you mean by that?
Yeah, so I think lazy meaning that you become so reliant on that technology that if all of a sudden it is not there, what do you do? Not knowing that process, not knowing who to go to next. So to your point, I think a lot of the information needs to be grounded. A lot of the information needs to be your information that you are feeding into these models. And if you don't know what's on that back end, it can be very dangerous.
Obviously, with Katrina as a good example, we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of it. You know, the systems across this entire city were down. There was no picking up your phone to look at where bin 7 was. You have to know where these things are at. So I think what we need to do is we go through, yes, we have these computers, these tools, ChatGPT, phones, but we also have to know like where things are located, how to use them, where the forms are at, how to fill those out with a pencil and paper. You know, it has to be able to be analog at some point, because if we have that large scale earthquake in California that we always talk about, you know, there's not going to be any computers to help us out.
Yeah, I think any time that you can add a tool to your toolbox, that's going to help. But you can't be so reliant that that's the only tool. Yesterday, I had heard someone say it's like taking a hammer and using a hammer for everything. That's not good. You know, now duct tape, it's got a lot of uses, but not for everything.
Right.
So you don't want to get down to just one tool and just hammer everything.
Right.
You want to know which ones to use and at what times. It's being able to use it in recovery to go, how can I get funding back to these individuals that are suffering and that have been impacted by doing those assessments faster, or maybe through utilizing imagery from drones or aerial imagery to do those before and after comparisons. So what I think is that when you look at AI, you really have to almost self-govern how you're using it to make sure that you're doing it in the most effective way.
Brian Head and Todd DeVoe, thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, it's my pleasure, anytime.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Brian Head is chair of the Fire Rescue Law Enforcement and Military Track for the National Hurricane Conference. He's the executive director with Buffalo Computer Graphics and a former employee with the New York State Emergency Management Office. Todd DeVoe is an emergency management coordinator for the city of Inglewood, California. In our third and final episode of our series on the 20th anniversary of Katrina coming this summer, we go to the banks of the Mississippi River and hear how efforts to control it have changed since the catastrophic storm. This show is thanks to astronomer and producer Seth Shostak, senior producer Gary Niederhoff, and assistant producers Brian Edwards and Shannon Rose Geary. I am Molly Bentley, the executive producer for Big Picture Science, and we'd like to give a big thanks to our listeners and our Patreon supporters. The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Big Picture Science that considers the role of old and new technology in communicating 20 years after Katrina is called Hurricane Comms.
It feels really good to be productive, but a lot of the time it's easier said than done, especially when you need to make time to learn about productivity so you can actually, you know, be productive. But you can start your morning off right and be ready to get stuff done in just a few minutes with the Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day podcast. New episodes drop every weekday, so listen and subscribe to Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts. That's Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts.
You ever wonder why flamingos are pink? Or how much taller the Eiffel Tower gets when the iron swells in the summer heat? Fun Facts Daily covers the odd and interesting things most of us never learned about in school. Like, did you know the Apollo 15 astronauts put a sculpture on the moon? Satisfy your curiosity every weekday with Fun Facts Daily. You'll get fun facts, a word of the day, practical tips, and brain teasers that'll challenge you to tell fact from fiction. So start every day smarter with Fun Facts Daily, wherever you get your podcasts.